All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2018-901, the State of Ohio versus Lance Hundley. For the appellant, Lasko?
Lasko.
May it please the court, counsel, distinguished guests, co-counsel. This matter before the court involves the mandatory appeal from a capital murder trial and conviction and imposition of death sentence upon Mr. Hundley, who was represented by myself and Mr. Cartwright Jones. Initially, Your Honors, I would request to reserve 10 minutes for purposes of rebuttal. Mr. Cartwright Jones will conclude the argument if that's permissible. This being a capital murder case, ordinarily it's a very convoluted appeal. However, this particular case is a bit different. It's a bit simpler. The issues that are before the court for purposes of consideration are explained in our brief, and I guess the best analogy that I could give is it's like an onion. There are multiple layers to our arguments. All of them have to be explained with respect to the connection and the correlation from one to the other. Yet there are certain items that are a little more important, we believe, than others. However, the entire argument follows through that analogy. The basis in this case is Mr. Hundley's right to a fair trial was materially prejudiced based upon the actions of the trial court. And the explanation, as best as we can phrase it, is this jury verdict, this death sentence that was handed down in this particular matter, was undermined by the actions of the trial court judge, which questions the reliability of that death verdict. In order to fully explain what I mean by that, I must look at a couple of very important precursor issues. One is the record in this case is replete with issues of problematic relationships between not only Mr. Hundley and his attorneys, which is evident on a review of the record with the number of counsel that he went through. He was constantly fighting with his attorneys, constantly battling with the court judge, and to the point of, on two separate occasions, after some inquiry by the court, he elected to represent himself. Once at a, I will call it not so serious stage, but at the time of a suppression hearing where he represented himself, and things went so badly and he was so unprepared that before the conclusion of that hearing, he asked the court to allow counsel to represent him because he realized he could not handle this. He was not prepared. He realized the gravity and nature of that responsibility. The court, however, prevented him from doing that and concluded that hearing. Subsequently, after the guilty verdict in the trial phase, on the morning set for mitigation, Mr. Hundley in a fit of rage or again, disagreement with not only his attorneys but the court, insisted that he represent himself. And as we saw from the transcript, when it came time for Mr. Hundley to present evidence of mitigation, and there was available mitigation, we know that from reviewing the transcripts, the voir dire, there was discussions as to his mental health, as to his harrowing childhood, as to some other issues that could have been presented. Mr. Hundley presented nothing. He simply said, I have nothing to offer, didn't even make a statement.
Was he not given a competency exam at some point?
He was. There was competency examinations that were done at the very beginning of the case.
Not alleging he was incompetent.
Not alleging that he
You're
was.
Just saying he had mental health issues.
I think the record is replete, even
though. I think the activity suggests that.
And I think that's also true, Your Honor. It was just I guess it's the attitude of the court at the beginning of the case compared to the attitude of the court at the end of the case. Very importantly, the issue that I'd like to address at length with the court is the answers to the questions of the jurors after Mr. Hundley presented nothing in mitigation are very telling with respect to what was in the minds of the jurors. It was obvious the jurors were holding out hope or some requesting some information that they could use to consider. When we look at the transcript, the first question they had was they wanted his medical records, they wanted his toxicology records. They wanted his mental health records, which had been mentioned but never presented. Obviously, the court denied that request. The second question.
Were they entered into evidence?
I don't believe they were ever.
And how could the jury be entitled to them?
They probably were not entitled to them based upon the fact that nothing was placed into evidence by Mr. Hundley during the mitigation phase.
During
the trial phase. There was some discussions. I believe counsel attempted to get into those. The judge made a comment relative to if you want to talk about mental health issues, you can call, I believe his name was Mr. Johnson, on mitigation. Kind of a precursor to the attitude of the judge with respect to how the outcome of the case was going to ultimately be disposed. The second question the jury asked again goes to the issue of what they were looking for, which ultimately.
Well, counsel, let me follow up on your theme here that the jurors wanted more and they weren't given it. Was it explained to them that this is not evidence? You're only to consider, you know, based on the instructions, evidence that was presented during trial. I mean, how was that handled?
Very simply, Your Honor, the court's answer to the question was no. That's it. No explanation whatsoever. When they asked for that type of information, they were simply told no. When they came back and asked if they could consider mercy as a mitigating factor, again, with respect to that question, their answer was simply no.
Is that inaccurate?
I believe it is. Counsel, we believe that it is, simply because the statute allows any factor to be considered mitigating. Anything that's a relevant item can be argued as mitigation for purposes of trying to shift the balance in the aggravating circumstances against the mitigating factors. So we believe that the judge's And again, it may have been couched, or it's been couched in this argument, as a jury instruction. It's clearly not an instruction. It's an answer to a question, which I think is a big difference in this particular matter. I bring all that to the ultimate issue, which is approximately 5 hours into deliberations, the jury comes into the courtroom and indicates that they have not a question, but rather a determination to inform the court that they're deadlocked. They cannot decide this case. I don't believe they use the exact term deadlock per se, but the idea is the same. They announce, the judge announces on the record, ladies and gentlemen, I have a note, jury is at a standstill, 11 of 12 in agreement, 12 is unwilling to change. The response that the court gives then is where the train comes off the tracks. The jury enters the courtroom at 3:45. By 3:47, the judge is done explaining to them or talking to them, and in fact I would estimate that the colloquy between the judge and the jury with respect to that statement probably lasted about 10 seconds, if that, because the statement that the judge made to them was, I'm going to inform you that you must deliberate until 4:30, and at 4:30 we will stop and you're going to go to a hotel. That's what the court instructed this juror. That's what they told him. That's what she told them when they requested or notified the court that they could not come to an agreement. Miraculously, 33 minutes later, 10 minutes before this self-imposed deadline that the judge had set to send them to the hotel for purposes of sequestration and continued deliberations the next day.
But that's not unusual to sequester a capital jury.
Not at all. Not at all.
Right. So I'm at a loss as to what the point is here.
I believe the point is, Judge, the judge, in my opinion, did two things wrong. One, an act of omission, one, an act of commission. The act of omission was, we all know juries have the responsibility to determine guilt or innocence. That's the function of the jury. And in this case, it's to decide whether the mitigating factors were enough to outweigh the aggravating circumstances. The jury informed the court that they were unable to do that. They indicated that it was 11-1 and that they were at a standstill. So instead of the court making inquiry into the extent of these deliberations or the possibility of is additional time necessary.
Well, counsel, was any of this objected to?
It was not objected to. Either after or during the time. As I said, Your Honor, there was probably the maximum 10 seconds that they were on the record with the jury. That's probably the time frame that we had. So I argue that the act of omission was the act of not making a determination, as Gapin indicates, into the extent of what the deadlock is. Is it irreconcilable? Is there any possibility that this can be done?
Counsel, how long had deliberations undergone before that exchange took place? When did the jury get the case?
They got the case approximately 10:30, 10:32 in the morning. This happened at about 3:45. So I would say almost 5 hours of deliberations had already occurred.
So the first day of deliberations, presumably they were told that they would be sequestered and to bring clothes with them to the courthouse.
I don't recall seeing anything on the record, but I assume that's part of the natural protocol for purposes of, you know, preparing a jury when it, when it's time for mitigation.
There was no request for a Howard charge to be read?
No, and that's, and again, that's another thing that the judge didn't do. She didn't make any inquiry, again, as to the extent of the deliberations. She didn't make a Howard charge. She simply said, you're going to go back, you're going to deliberate, or we're going to a hotel. That's it. Which leads me into my argument with respect to the act of commission, in that she took away one juror's opportunity to be able to keep a death penalty from being imposed. She exercised her will over the jury by giving them an ultimatum, basically, or a threat. Here's what's going to happen. We're not going to talk about where you're at. We're not going to, I'm not even going to ask you anything. I'm simply going to tell you this is what we're going to do. And that's what happened. And as I said, 33 minutes later, now all of a sudden we have this unanimous jury verdict, and Mr. Hundley is in the position that he's in now. There were a lot of options. The Howard charge, the Martin charge, the one that's a little more finessing, I would characterize it. Those are all things that could have been done. But it seemed that, as I said, the judge's attitude at the beginning wore thin as the trial went on. In fact, on the record, we know that at one point in time, the judge told the defendant, when he requested for the second time to represent himself, and it was obvious how badly he performed the first time, because he realized he couldn't do it. He got through the end of the hearing and asked for counsel, and she denied that. She made the statement, well, if you want to represent yourself, fine, but when you get the death penalty, I don't want you to complain to me about it. That is indicative, I believe, in looking at the record as a whole, of the court's opinion, the court's changing of her attitude as the case wore on.
Well, counsel, your client was continuously going back and forth about representation issues, not just once, not just twice, numerous times, had change of counsel, had public defender brought in. I don't know how many attorneys he had, and the judge each time said, okay, I'll allow the withdrawal, I'll appoint something else, somebody else. I'll appoint standby. I'll appoint the public defender. Your client's inability to make decisions and then at the last minute stick to those decisions was demonstrated as well, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So to say that the judge is trying to caution him that, and your client knew the death penalty was on the table, that the most severe thing can happen to you, and that's going to be a consequence if you keep this up at the rate you're going, which is a translation of what she said, that doesn't indicate a predisposition.
I think that's exactly the reason, as you pointed out, Judge, this is the ultimate penalty, the ultimate.
This is what you're facing, Mr. Hundley, if you continue this.
Which goes more to my position that the judge should have been more careful or have been a little more, I don't want to use the term looking out for Mr. Hundley, but making sure that his rights were protected in this particular matter.
Sometimes you can't protect people from themselves.
Well, and
your client was desperate to represent himself.
I don't know that I would conclude that. I would say that his determination of whether he could represent himself was clouded based upon his mental health issues. I mean, as obvious as that was throughout the trial, the nature of, as you said, him going back and forth with respect to counsel, it was always an argument as to what was presented, how the judge explained something, did he understand things, albeit that he was competent. I think mental health played a large role in this, and the judge was obviously aware. There just wasn't the protection. And not only that, but the way that the jury was handled by the judge, irrespective of the choice that Mr. Hundley made, was simply just, in a capital murder case, was not the appropriate way under the law, under Brooks, under Foster, under the cases that this court has set down when juries indicate that they're at a deadlock. Albeit some of it was brought upon by Mr. Hundley, given the fact that he decided to represent himself, which again turned out to be a disaster at the last minute and presented no evidence. All of that, though, gets us to where we're at. The judge has a duty to make sure that his rights are protected, that the jury verdict is fair and reliable. And looking at all of the circumstances in this case, I don't think the judge accurately did that. I think that's obvious from looking at the answers to the questions and the way that this was prepared. Obviously, we can't know what was in the minds of the jurors, but we know specifically from the pointed questions that the jurors made during the mitigation deliberations. There was one juror that didn't want to put Mr. Hundley to death. I think that's obvious. I don't think there's any way to dispute that. Requesting some medical records, requesting can we consider the mercy as a mitigating factor? I think it's obvious that that was what was going on.
Counsel, let me just caution you. You have 8 minutes and 30 seconds left if you want to reserve rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the remaining.
Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Attorney Ralph Rivera, on behalf of the State of Ohio and the Mahoney County Prosecutor's Office, kind of pick up where Attorney Lasko left off. The trial court, if you go back to the earlier instructions during mitigation, properly instructed the jury pursuant to Ohio law. And defense counsel brought up recent cases like Ford and Brooks. Those circumstances are not present in this case. State versus Ford, which is a recent case, in that case, the trial court made some misstatements during voir dire. The trial court then thereafter properly instructed the jury in mitigation. This court found that any earlier misstatements were cured by those later instructions. That situation is not present here. In Brooks, basically laid the foundation of what the proper instruction is. Clearly, the court properly instructed in the earlier instructions. The court continued to properly instruct the jury, but just wanted to point out that those situations in Brooks and Ford, those are not present here. The trial court clearly told the jury that one juror may prevent a death penalty determination. She clearly told the jury that. They were aware of that. We now know that there was possibly one juror that was holding out. But I kind of wanted to point out the fact that when the jury had that question or that statement, they didn't indicate whether they were 11-1 in favor of death or life. The parties had no indication. Maybe they could infer what the jury was thinking based on the evidence that was presented in mitigation. But it wasn't as if the jury came back and said, we're 11-1. The trial court properly, and kind of touching upon the earlier instructions, when they asked for evidence, The court answered correctly. Those reports are not in evidence. You can't have it. The mercy instruction.
Wait a minute. Let me clarify. The court said those reports are not in evidence. Or did he just say no, which is what I heard Mr. Lasko say?
The question was, quote, can we have access to defense's evidence, including medical records, talks report for Lance? And this is the court talking. And the court answered, quote, they were not admitted into evidence. So you have what you have. Thank you. That was the answer. And that is a proper, that's a proper statement.
All right, well, that's a little different than what was said earlier.
The second question was, is mercy considered a mitigating factor under Ohio law? The court answered, quote, the answer is no. It's in the, I believe, the seventh proposition of law, it's clearly established law that mercy is not to be considered a mitigating factor. And then to the last question, the jury is at a standstill, 11 of 12 in agreement, 12 unwilling to change. She then instructed them, I am going to inform you, you must deliberate until 4:30. At 4:30, we will stop and go to the hotel. She did. That is the instruction that she gave the jury. But if you compare this circumstance to the circumstances in Springer, Gapin, and Brown, and even Mason, the facts in this case pale in comparison to those, to the facts in those, the cases that I just mentioned, where the court in Springer, the trial court found that the jury was hopelessly deadlocked. And the court set forth the law where when that does happen, the trial court must instruct that they only consider the life options. Gapin, the trial court found, or this court found that it kind of elaborated on how you find or how you determine that the jury is deadlocked. There's no bright line test. The court must consider each case on its own, considering the individual facts that are present. Gapin, the court did not find that the jury was deadlocked. That case, there was, the death verdict came on the third day of deliberations and after approximately 18 hours of deliberations. Here, we have approximately five, probably less if you count in some, the breaks that the jury take, or that the jury took, but let's say five. In Gapin, you had the Howard charge. You had a defense objection to the charge. Gapin, the other interesting fact in Gapin was the jury stated that it cannot unanimously agree on a specific life sentence and are unable to render a sentence verdict. Defense counsel argued that the jury had already rejected the death sentence. The trial court thereafter instructed the jury to consider all sentences. This court found that was not an abuse of discretion. State versus Mark Brown, which is another case that originated from Mahoning County. In that case, you had the verdict come down on day three, like Gapin, but after some 27 hours of deliberations. In that case, you had day one, there were 6 hours. The second day, there was a Howard charge after 5 hours, then seven more hours of deliberation. On the third day, you had approximately...
Counsel, do you think it would have been more appropriate for the trial court to have given the Howard charge and then sent them back in? I mean, was this a... I know it was less than 5 hours probably total that they had devoted to this task at that point.
Would have been an appropriate, if it was requested, I think she may have given
but neither,
the charge.
But they were not, that charge was not requested by the counsel?
No. And again, we're talking less than 5 hours. The jury, it was one question. It was, in the cases that I mentioned, the jury sends out multiple questions saying, we're at a standstill, we're deadlocked, we can't decide. Certainly, if the jury would have came out with another question, then certainly a Howard charge would probably have been probably more appropriate at that point. But again, there was no further questions. And those, that is one of the, some of the main points in the cases that I mentioned. Just to kind of finish off State versus Brown, defense counsel filed, they moved twice. Twice they asked the trial court to take death off the table. The trial court said no, based on the answers for the jury. This court found that that was not an abuse of discretion. The kind of working backwards, the trial court's comment about when you get convicted of death, I don't want to hear about it. As this court mentioned, yes, this was after now, it was the third time officially that Mr. Hundley requested to represent himself. The mitigation colloquy regarding his waiver was the third time that the trial court went through the colloquy. There was one at the suppression hearing. There was another one that followed in September. I think it was September of 17 before it was kind of in the interim between when before Attorney Myers was appointed to the case. The court went through a second colloquy. A waiver was signed. The mitigation was now the third time. And I have to point out that the court, this was on page 2039 of the transcript. On page 2042, Attorney Greg Myers stated he essentially agreed with the trial court and warned Mr. Hundley. And he, kind of touching upon Mr. Hundley's competency, which was dealt with earlier on in the proceedings and not relitigated or not brought up once Attorney Myers was appointed to the case. Attorney Myers told the court, I have no question that Lance Hundley is competent. I lay that predicate out. I know the court has examined that before I arrived, and I, in good conscience, as an officer of the court, can't say anything other than he is competent. That means he has the right to choose, even if it's going to hurt him. Justice Scalia said that in one of the main cases in this area. Although I would here in open court vigorously advise you not to represent, I think that is the path of death. Attorney Myers essentially told Mr. Hundley the exact same thing that the court, maybe a little bit more eloquently than the trial court laid it out, but it was the exact same warning that the trial court gave. And when you have to take it in the context of the proceeding. This was not like the Townsend case that counsel cited and that talks about facetious statements. Those are all sentencing proceedings. This is not a sentencing proceeding. This is before mitigation even happens. So this is not a situation where the trial court, as she's sentencing him, says, you know, hey, you know, you shouldn't have represented yourself in mitigation. You know, I warned you. So, you know, you're getting the death penalty. That is very different from what occurred here. Start at the beginning. The prior calculation and design, which kind of encompasses the first and second assignments of error, they pretty much start and end with Dr. Filo's testimony. Dr. Filo testified that this was an extended, deliberate attack that occurred. This was not a spontaneous kind of fit of rage situation. There's no evidence whatsoever that this happened in a matter of seconds. In fact, Dr. Filo testified.
Counselor, what evidence was there that it did not? I mean, the sustained attack and then the ultimate fire, but the doctor testified that the fire was postmortem. Why? What evidence is there that it happened, that it did not happen spontaneously?
I think specifically Dr. Filo's testimony and where when he was asked about the time frame of when this occurred, and it was based on the victim's injuries. And when I say victim, I'm speaking of Mrs. Huff, who was the decedent, her injuries, and based on the bruising that happened. He testified, quote, several minutes up to hours. It certainly was not an immediate death. He goes on to say that the beating takes a while because of the amount of blood that it's accumulated in her body and the fact that the bruising is developing. So he's looking at the bruising that's all over her body.
And I'm sorry, I don't recall. Did he say the strangulation took place or the beatings?
He clearly testified that the strangulation took place after the beating, and that was, again, based on the hemorrhaging in her eyes and the bruising and the development of the bruises on her body. He clearly testified to that. She suffered.
So that even if it did arise spontaneously or something happened or triggered it, there was ample amount of time to stop before death.
Yes, and that's the Taylor case that I cited in my brief kind of basically demonstrates that. It was out of this court. There was an argument in a bar. The defendant shoots the victim, and while the victim, the decedent, is still alive, he's kind of crawling and trying to get away. He then kind of follows him and then proceeds to shoot him several more times, and that's exactly what this court found was, while the initial shot may or may not have come upon spontaneously, following the victim and then finishing the victim off certainly establishes that prior calculation and design. She suffered, kind of just going through her left eye, forehead, left cheek, the right side of her face, her nose, her upper lip area, upper arm, her chest, which caused rib fractures. Do you have a question, Your Honor?
No.
Okay. The abdomen, so the two main injuries besides the strangulation, which Dr. Fila testified finished her off, was the abdomen. The force to her abdomen tore a major vein, led to massive internal bleeding around her stomach. She lost a significant amount of blood. And he testified that it was this abdomen wound in combination with the strangulation that ultimately caused her death. And again, he testified that this went on, for at least several minutes up to an hour. We also know from the testimony that her life alert went off somewhere around 2 a.m. The first 911 call and Youngstown police did not respond till about 3:00. So you have an hour, at least an hour that's accounted for, where not only is Ms. Huff being attacked, but then when her at some point when Ms. Johnson comes to the house and then she is then attacked by the defendant. Again, I'd like to also point out the EMT. She testified that when Mr. Hundley came to the door, she quote, he was very kind, very polite, no anxiety given off or anything like that, just a very nice man talking to us, very calm. Again, I think that clearly shows that this was not a spontaneous attack. I mean, this was after the alert went off.
A side question, and it really has nothing much to do with the case, but when the EMT arrived in response to the first alert button, there is no indication when they arrive on who they're checking on, whether it's male or female, and, you know, an adult with a disability, or they just respond to the residents?
There was some questioning, and the EMT testified that she personally did not have that information. There was other testimony, I believe, through the detective that said, that alluded to, yes, that information was passed along, but at some point it kind of got lost in translation.
So when she went to the door, she didn't know who?
That's exactly what she testified to. She testified that emergency calls, or false alarms, I'm sorry, false alarms are common. Mm-hmm. She did not know who the victim or who she was responding to, whether it was a male or a female.
And her partner didn't have that information either?
I don't think so. And I don't know if that specific question was asked, but she certainly testified. I, I
Sure, and I know it just doesn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, that was a subject of a civil lawsuit. But she clearly testified that she did not have that information. So when Mr. Hundley said, you know, I'm fine, it was an accident, they then left. The, again, some of his statements, when Ms. Johnson got to the house, she came in, you know, the smell of gasoline, the defendant had the gas can. He told her, you know, you better get right with the Lord because you're going to meet your maker. That clearly shows his mental state. He was planning, and clearly tried to kill her that night. He then went on to say, I killed your daughter, I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to kill your son, who at this point wasn't even there, wasn't even present at the scene. But that, all of this in conjunction shows that this is just not some spontaneous event. This is how it started. Obviously, we don't know, but it evolved. When it started, it wasn't stopping, and that was his intent. And that is based on Dr. Filo's testimony. That's based on his calm demeanor, his subsequent changing clothes after this happened. I mean, in the interim, I mean, he changed his clothes. He put them in a bag. He admitted to that in his own testimony, that he changed his clothes, put them in a bag. I mean, that just shows, again, his mental state. He was calm, he was collected, and kind of, transitioning into his waiver of counsel. If you put everything in context, the entire proceedings, he was upset with counsel, and he did. He went through numerous attorneys. Numerous experienced defense attorneys. He wanted to control the defense. He wasn't happy with Attorney Uhas and the expert, and the pace of it. He wanted the case to go to trial. He wasn't happy that the case may be delayed or could be delayed based on retaining their own defense expert, which Attorney Uhas said, it was his opinion that was warranted at that point. Mr. Hundley was not happy about that. This all goes back to Mr. Hundley wanting to control the show and be his own counsel. That's kind of shown in his later statement. He says it during the colloquy at mitigation that, I think even, it might have been his statement to the jury, where he says, I should have done this a long time ago. I should have done this earlier. So from the very beginning, he wanted to control the show. His waiver, again, as I stated, the trial court went through the colloquy three separate times. First time, he waived for the suppression hearing. He then, after the suppression hearing, he then changed his mind and would not sign the waiver form. Thereafter, in September, he continued. He wanted to represent himself. September 6th of 17, trial court goes through another colloquy. He then signs the waiver. And if you look through those waivers, these are detailed waiver forms. It's not a 2 to 3 sentences of, I'm waiving my right to counsel. They are detailed colloquies. The trial court had detailed colloquies, and the waiver forms are detailed. The defendant clearly, knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waived his right to counsel, again, on three separate occasions. The only one that's at heart in this appeal is the later mitigation. But again, he clearly waived his right. And in that September, there's that time frame of September through about November, he was representing himself for about a 1 to 2 month period before Attorney Myers was officially appointed. And he then met with Attorney Myers and was comfortable with Attorney Myers' representation. And he agreed to he wisely, at least to that point, allowed Attorney Myers to represent him during the trial proceedings. Just to kind of touch upon standby counsel. I have to point out that nowhere in this record, at least I couldn't find it. I could not find where defendant requested standby counsel. So kind of in the context of number one, he didn't request it. And again, this proposition of law only goes to the suppression hearing. That is what is in the briefs. We're talking about the suppression hearing only. Counsel, number one, the defendant does not have a constitutional right to standby counsel, number one. Number two, counsel was present at all times during the suppression hearing. There's a discussion with Attorney Juhas, a lengthy discussion, in fact, because they are discussing this this expert and the continuances. And the defendant, after this discussion, says, now I want to represent myself. After the suppression hearing is run, Attorney Juhas, Attorney Taylor, they didn't go anywhere. They were there the entire time. Number one, he didn't request standby counsel. Number two, counsel was there the entire time. After the conclusion of the hearing, he felt that he basically had a change of heart. I don't want to represent myself. Attorney Juhas then continued to take over. He requested the court to reopen the suppression hearing, which she denied. And then the case proceeded. And then thereafter, in September of 17, he again waived his right to counsel. But again, at no time did he request standby counsel. If there are no further questions from the court, I would simply request that the court affirm his conviction and sentence of death.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cartwright-Jones.
Thank you for hearing us this morning, Your Honors. As my colleague, Mr. Lasko, did, I am here to urge this court, at the very least, to vacate the death sentence in this cause and to spare Mr. Hundley's life. And I think by way of rebuttal, when we look at the several points that Mr. Lasko discussed through the lens that Mr. Rivera refined them, I think I see three things that speak to cumulativity of error. The first one, looking at the, what I'll call the third jury issue, which is the jury coming back and saying, we are at a standstill 5 hours into deliberation. Now, where state's counsel cited Brown, Gapin, and Mason, all of which are this court's decisions in sort of the line of genealogy from Brooks, those differ sharply from what happened here. Particularly, I want to point to Brown and Mason. Brown and Mason respectively allow a judge to make an inquiry into exactly how deadlocked a jury is, and then respectively to read a Howard charge or the slightly softer, more nuanced Martin's charge. And those are fine ways as far as law to deal with it, but none of those happened here. Two things did not happen that distinguish this matter from both Brown and Mason. First of all, there's no inquiry as to deadlock. There is just simply, we are going to deliberate until 4:30, at which point you will be sequestered to a hotel. I will refer to a question this court asked earlier. Your Honor, you inquired how, isn't it rather often that you'd be sequestered during capital deliberations and that you would know to bring clothes and things like that? The topic of an overnight stay occurs days earlier in general panel voir dire. It does not occur in the instructions during mitigation. So other than no inquiry into the nature or extent of the deadlock, then of course we don't see the approved of remedies from Brown and Mason, either a Howard charge or a Martin's charge. We just have go, and then you're going into a hotel. I will add, of course, the general voir dire transcript reveals the usual things you hear in voir dire about why jurors who have families and jobs and lives would be troubled by going to a hotel. I know it's a possibility, but rather than the encouragement to deliberate and consider and reconsider opinions that we see in the Howard charge and the Martin's charge, we just simply have go to a hotel. They are two totally different things. So with that point, I want to just leave the two big issues. First, there was no inquiry whatsoever into the existence or extent of a deadlock, which is a condition precedent to reading a Howard charge or a Martins charge. Neither of those things happened here. Those doctrines do not apply. We are simply left with the Brooks doctrine for failure to apply the procedures and remedies of Brown and Mason that simply says the correct thing to do, because the court didn't do anything else, was to encourage the jury to deliberate on the non-death options. That didn't happen here. I think the appropriate remedy is to remand to the court to consider the life options, or what I call the non-death options. So secondly, you heard Mr. Lasko and I heard discussion with the court on the tox results. The jury asked for the tox results. That's right, Your Honor, you're correct. Those didn't come into evidence because with a minute to prepare his mitigation in a fit of pique, Hundley failed to exercise the nuance that an experienced capital attorney would do to get those things into evidence. But it tells us about the psychology of the jury. That question, and of course the mercy question, and the deadlock, tell us that that jury did not want to kill. That was not a killing jury. It wasn't a killing jury until the court sent them back with a threat of a hotel stay, essentially to impose a death verdict. Now, the mercy instruction is interesting because it's true. Ohio law, differing somewhat from the rest of the nation, does not countenance the reading of a mercy instruction to a jury. But this isn't a jury instruction issue. This is a jury question issue. The jury came out and said, can we consider mercy? The jury asked that unprompted, on its own, can we consider mercy? Which, to me, says this was not a killing jury. So upon the question, can we consider mercy, the court says no. That's not the right answer. There are two correct answers I'd propose. The correct answer that I happen to like, Your Honors, is yes. Yes, you may consider mercy. Yes, you may consider anything as mitigating. That's the whole point of mitigation, even during the state's voir dire. You hear over and over, mitigation can be that a defendant makes really nice origami swans. Anything can be mitigating, so of course mercy can be mitigating. I'd posit to this court, the correct answer was yes. Now, there is a slightly more nuanced and legalistic answer, which I would propose is a rereading of the jury instruction that basically says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you may consider any factor mitigating that was presented to you. Naturally, I prefer yes, go consider mercy, but either answer would be correct. But I offer to this court no, in the context of a jury question, may we consider mercy, is absolutely the wrong answer. So we take a look at those three things and everything else we've got. Now, I suppose on mercy, one could go back and say, well, of course, even if you want to say that that's the wrong answer, she did read the proper jury instruction on what mitigation is. But when we look at those several things in the context of cumulativity of error, a man who came before the court with antisocial personality disorder, with minutes as an unsophisticated human being to prepare a mitigation, with a jury that I would propose was really instructed the wrong way, both on what mercy is and how to conduct their deliberations on a deadlock. I think, yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Cartwright Jones, let's go back a minute to your mercy argument. Are you saying that if a juror asks, can we consider mercy as a mitigating factor, and the court says no, are you making that akin to the court saying you must come back with a death sentence?
No, I just think it's the wrong answer.
Okay.
Certainly not. Now, I think all of those things pushed a non-killing jury much toward a death sentence, particularly by 4:30, or by the discussion they'd go to a hotel by 4:30 that evening. Now that I think about it as you ask, I suppose saying no, you may not consider mercy does push a jury that much further to death. Yes, actually.
No, but it was no, you must not consider mercy as a mitigating factor. Not that you can't consider mercy at all. I guess what I was trying to glean, even from reading the briefs, is whether you were saying that took away a jury's option not to recommend death.
Or not to recommend life.
Or not to recommend, you're correct.
Right, yes, I mean, in that context, I think it did. Because what else did they have to go on other than mercy, considering that there was zero other mitigation?
And so I wonder if you, I know you've only got a couple of minutes left. Let's assume for the moment that what if we don't agree with you on the errors that you have raised? We also have the obligation to do an independent sentence evaluation. Can you speak to that? What factors would you have us look at to say this was not a situation where the death penalty should have been imposed?
Yes, absolutely. I would look to the factors of everything that we've cited, and I would put them under the doctrine of cumulativity of error, that when you look at this and you look at the way this case was handled, it is what I might call a dateline case. It undermines the public confidence in the death penalty, in the courts, and in the capital trial process. I don't think that a situation where we have those three points that we cited and where we have a court who, granted, in frustration with the defendant, acted out on same and made the statements that she did, that we can look at that and say, this is really the standard that we have to live up to impose a sentence of death. So for those reasons, I'm asking this court to spare Mr. Hundley's life. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.